Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the April edition of City Talks, where we'll be discussing next month's election of the Metro Mayors. Before we get into that, I'm joined by my colleagues Brian Semple and Naomi Clayton to discuss the recently introduced apprenticeship levy, the recently increased national living wage, and the latest on the Metro Mayor contests. So the beginning of April saw the introduction of the apprenticeship levy and the living wage. So Naomi, just give us a sense as to what they are, but also how they will play out differently. Let's take the apprenticeship levy first.
So the apprenticeship levy was introduced last week, and that will mean employers with a wage bill of more than 3 million will be required to pay the apprenticeship levy. That money will then sit in a digital account, and employers will be able to access that funding to fund apprenticeship training. The evidence shows that that can have a genuine impact on skills and employment, so improving skills levels, stimulating further training, and boosting employment. But there's concerns that the new reforms won't address where the need and demand for apprenticeships is greatest, especially in our northern cities, or indeed create more kind of genuine training opportunities for young people.
So is there an issue about where the money is generated and then where it's spent? Is there any controls or any issues associated with that?
Yeah, so there are concerns that that essentially the apprenticeship money might well be spent where it's raised. So we know that there are around twice as many firms likely to be paying the levy in London compared to the North East in Yorkshire. But the latest figures suggest that there are around 1.6 times more applications per apprenticeship vacancy in the North East and Yorkshire. So there's fears that, you know, essentially the levy will be reinvested where it's raised, meaning that places in the north essentially may well miss out on the opportunities to kind of create more opportunities.
And is there any mechanism for reallocation or redistribution in the current system to take some monies or some activity from one part and move it to another part of the country?
Well, non-levy paying businesses will still be able to access up to 90% of the costs of apprenticeship training. So there's an important role for cities and local partners in terms of raising awareness of the subsidies available, raising awareness of the benefits that apprenticeships can bring to businesses to ensure that demand for apprenticeships is driven up outside London and the South East.
Yeah, so it's another interesting example of, you know, this tension between the government's agenda on the one hand to rebalance the economy, and obviously boosting skills is an important element of that, versus really putting resources where the economy is already strong, which is typically London and the South East. And so, you know, those two tensions are always evident across different policy fields, aren't they?
Yes. And I think, you know, the northern cities have historically been the ones that have generated apprenticeship opportunities, and clearly government and city leaders need to look at ways to continue to support employers in northern cities to offer those opportunities.
Yeah, so as always, I think the, you know, the geography element and understanding the geography of the apprenticeship levy gives us a real insight into some of the policy challenges and opportunities. Let's turn to living wage. So that was, the living wage went up on April the 1st. It was obviously introduced 12 months ago, but it's gone up. So what's the current level? And again, give us a sense as to how the geography of that living wage plays out across different cities.
Yeah, so as you say, obviously the National Living Wage was introduced last year and it's just been increased to £7.50. And again, the impacts of this policy will play out very differently across different parts of the country. So our analysis shows that the National Living Wage is likely to have a much greater impact in cities outside of London and the South East. So, for example, one in seven employees in Wigan, Doncaster and Hull are likely to see an increase in their wages as a direct result of the increase in the National Living Wage.
Yeah.
And that contrasts to just one in 40 in Oxford.
Mm.
So, as always, it'll have very, very different impacts in different parts of the country. And we can see those impacts have already started to play out from last year's increases, with low-wage workers in Manchester, for example, seeing much larger increases in their wages compared to other workers in the city.
And one of the concerns that other commentators have expressed is, in a sense, in some of our cities where the economy is less strong, wages are slightly lower, and essentially this creates a wage floor where a vast proportion of the workforce will be in and around this new level. What are your reflections on that?
So we know that proportionately more workers are likely to benefit in low wage cities, predominantly cities in the north. And it's too early to tell whether the new living wage has an impact on employment.
Yes.
Historically, the minimum wage hasn't had an impact on employment, but just as the new rates benefit more workers, it might well increase pressures on employers to a greater extent in northern cities.
And that will play out quite differently, wouldn't it, in a sense? The pressures on, the labour costs for some firms in some cities will be much higher as a proportion of their overall turnover than it will in other places. So you would expect a sort of geographical issue to how close they are to that threshold.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So let's turn to, we're under a month now to the mayoral, Metro mayoral elections in our six areas outside of London. We've been doing quite a bit of work in the run-up to talking to and holding hustings, observing what the priorities are. We'll come to the sort of policy questions and issues that the mayors are putting forward now as we begin to see more there. Manifestos, but just give us a sense as to where we are on the politics. Who's the runners and riders? Who's likely to be, in the mayoral seat come May the 5th, May the 6th?
Well, that's right, Andrew. We've been up and down the country with hustings events over the past few weeks, and speaking to the National journalists about it, our recent press briefing that we held on the kind of key battles in the upcoming elections, and there's a few trends that really emerged from that. Firstly, that the key political battleground in the upcoming elections likely to be the West Midlands. So our analysis shows that Labour was about 10 points ahead of the Conservatives in the general election in 2015, but the Conservatives have really thrown everything at this election. They've backed their candidate Andy Street to the hilt. It's been something that they've prioritised in conference speeches and all the rest of it. And so there is a feeling that that is going to be the closest election. In fact, John Curtis at our recent press event suggested it's about a 50-50 chance for Andy Street compared to Labour's candidate, Sean Simon. So I expect that one to be the closest call. And I think that that's probably the city region that national media are most likely to focus in on in the coming weeks. Another big issue that has emerged from some of the events that we've had is question marks around turnout and what we're likely to see.
Yeah.
So while we're seeing that local engagement in the elections is really picking up, there's been increased national media attention on these elections, it's still questions as to how many people are going to turn out on the day to vote. Experts is that it might be slightly less than local government elections, slightly more than the police commissioners. And certainly in places like Liverpool, Greater Manchester, where Labour are very much favourites to win, it could be as low as around 25%.
Yeah, it's an interesting one then. I mean, I was looking at some of the numbers. I think around in the very first election for the London mayor, the turnout was around the 30, just over the 30% mark in 2000. And obviously the very latest election, we had the biggest turnout we've had, and that was up towards 45, 46%. So, you know, there is a benchmark, but we shouldn't be expecting half the population to be turning out for these mayoral elections, should we?
I think that's right. And, you know, there's obviously still work to be done in terms of raising public awareness of these, of the roles and what they can do. As I say, you know, we've had great turnout for the events we've been holding around the country. There's clearly an interest and an appetite to find out more, but that still has some way to go in terms of cutting across, you know, the wider public in these places. And I think, you know, on a more optimistic note, one interesting point that Professor Tony Travers made at our recent press briefing was that while there may not be a great deal of awareness or as much awareness as we would like about the new mayors, the track record of places which have had mayors in the past couple of decades suggests that when the mayors come into place, they're generally very popular.
Yeah.
So if you look at London, if you look at other cities around the country, it's partly to do with the fact that the very format of a mayoral election kind of forces candidates to take quite a centrist approach, step out of party politics and the kind of positions that they would maybe be forced to take with that, and to really just try and appeal across the board as much as possible. And also because then when the mayors are in office, you start to see the actual impact they can have in terms of, you know, matters, issues that matter most to people's day-to-day lives, so transport and housing. So that's something that we hopefully will see that similar pattern play out as the new mayors come into play following the elections in May.
Yeah, well, and it's a good point around what they inevitably focus on, because as we see more of the manifestos being released now by the candidates in the six areas, issues around skills, apprenticeships, you know, good wages for good jobs, those sorts of ideas and themes, they seem to be a pretty consistent theme across all of the different areas and obviously across many of the candidates, irrespective of their political colour. Naomi?
Absolutely. So, you know, improving employment opportunities through apprenticeships, raising standards of living will all, you know, will feature in all of the manifestos. And the mayors need to think about how they can use the powers that they've got to create the environment for businesses to thrive, to enable them to pay higher wages, but also how they can use their soft powers to convene partners in the local area and challenge partners to improve the opportunities available to people in their local communities. Mm.
And I think that was something that we did see when listening to candidates in different parts of different city regions electing mayor. There is a sense that the candidates are aware that they don't need to just think about the formal powers that are on the table. That we're starting to hear ideas that go beyond that, and, you know, different candidates thinking, how can I use my mandate to really make bold decisions and have bold interventions in their city regions?
Well, by the time we come back to our next episode of City Talks, we'll know who those mayors are going to be, and we'll have a clear idea about what their programme is going to be for the next 3 years and indeed beyond. Many thanks to Naomi Clayton and Brian Semple.
In less than a month, six areas across England will be electing their first metro mayors. These new mayors will need to hit the ground running with a clear understanding of what they want to achieve, the powers at their disposal to do so, and how they intend to maximise their broader political power as the directly elected leader of their areas. And the way in which the new mayors choose to organise their offices, appoint their teams, prioritise their policies, and interact with key interests, including government and business, outside of their city, will all hugely impact on their chances of success.
To explore the challenges these new mayors will face and how they can be overcome, I have two guests who between them were at the heart of the London mayoral system for its first 16 years. Sir Edward Lister, former Deputy Mayor for Planning and Chief of Staff to Mayor Johnson, and before that was leader of Wandsworth Council for 19 years. And Neil Corman, CBE, former Senior Advisor to both Mayor Livingstone and Mayor Johnson, where amongst other things he led in the London Olympics and Paralympics programme. So first off, before we get into the detail, I'm quite keen just to get your thoughts on the advantages of a direct elected mayor over other forms of leadership. Ed, you were the leader of a council and then worked for the mayor. What did you see as the advantages of having a mayoral system for a city like London?
I think in the London context, it was London, you must remember, going back in time, London didn't have a central administration. Mm. It had London councils, which brought together the 32 London boroughs. They worked together very successfully, but they were not providing city leadership. Mm-hmm. And that was the great big hole, and the first elected mayor plugged that very successfully. We got focus on the city. People started talking about London as a city, London as a place. And it brought together everybody together, working together. And there may have been political differences about things, but the overall message was all about London. Mm.
Neil, you work for Ken Livingstone as he came into power and then throughout his first two terms. What did you see as the advantages of the mayor? Because obviously he was also the leader of the GLC, which had a different format in bygone days.
Yes, and Ken was always very clear, actually, although with classic, as he always was, having started off opposing the mayoralty, he became very clear that it was a much better system than the GLC. And I think what Ed has said, I mean, the powers are perhaps not so important. I mean, they are important and we can perhaps talk about them. But when Ken came in, there were quite limited powers. There had been at least two lots of legislation which have increased the power of the mayor in London because of its success. But the big thing was to give a voice to the city. And this is one of the things about mayors and why I've always strongly supported the creation of mayors. And I regret that we don't have them throughout the big cities of this country, because they do have this great convening power to give leadership, to give civic leadership, to bring people together, often to address problems that are nothing to do with their formal powers. And time after time, you can see that. And obviously, the classic thing in London was it would have been quite impossible for London to mount a bid for the Olympic Games without a mayor, without that civic leadership. And when you had that, you were able to bring together a whole range of people who were able to put together a tremendously successful bid and in due course a tremendously successful Olympic and Paralympic Games. Mm. And that in itself, I think, is testament to the power that mayors can bring to cities.
Yeah, I mean, it already raises that sort of issue. When we look at the, you know, the mayors that we'll have outside of London, Ed, you know, there's a critique that they won't be as powerful as the London mayor, and yet when we look at the London mayor, you know, we often say it's not as powerful as the New York mayor and elsewhere. But it's also this issue about the balance between the hard and soft powers. I mean, your reflections on how mayors get that right, in the sense how they maximise the powers they got, but also both Johnson and Livingstone step well beyond their brief on many occasions, and for good reason as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Both of them did it. Both of them regarded themselves as the leading spokesman for the city.
Yeah.
And they felt it was well within their role to comment on absolutely anything that related to London. And I'm sure that's going to be the case with these new metro mayors in Birmingham, in Manchester, in Liverpool and all the other cities. We will have people who will actually go well beyond their powers. And of course, their powers will steadily increase, as Neil said. Remember, there were two GLA acts, the first one in 2000, and then we had the one in 2012, which brought a second set of powers through, and all sorts of odds and ends in between
yeah.
time.
Mm.
They were constantly absorbing powers, but it didn't stop them talking. I mean, Boris convened very, very successfully Lord Darzi's review on health services. That's not part of his brief.
No.
He was very much doing that. He convened the Andrew Travers review on financing of local government. Again, well beyond his brief.
Yeah.
So they were quite happy to. And Ken did similar things.
Yeah,
I mean, I think bringing this back to the Metro Mayors, there's a sort of tension here, which I think we all know about, which is that essentially, in these other cities, many people didn't really want to have a mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a big difference to some extent between London and the metro mayors, which is an important one, which is that in London, you have this situation where I think there was genuine popular support for the recreation of citywide government. There was a referendum in London. There was strong public support for the creation of a new institution. I think, and this is speaking from someone who doesn't come obviously from any of the cities, but my strong impression is that it isn't quite like that in these other places.
Yeah.
It has been more top-down than bottom-up. There weren't referendums. Essentially, people were told by the then Chancellor, George Osborne, if you want this devolution, you're going to have to accept the mayor.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you start off with perhaps a couple of quite big issues, one in terms of popular legitimacy, and the second in terms of how you handle the relationships with the existing local authority leaders who have more power in the new system than they do in London. And that's obviously, you know, that is going to be a big issue. And particularly because certainly in Manchester and Liverpool and in West Midlands as well, you are seeing some big political or business personalities coming forward to stand for these jobs, which possibly wasn't anticipated at the time. I think in a number of cases, people thought that local politicians who didn't have a Westminster background would be elected.
Mm.
Now, frankly, if, as I would expect, Steve Rotherham and Andy Burnham are elected, and it's going to be a much closer run thing in the West Midlands, these are big political figures, and they are going to have very significant power and big voices, just as Ed has said. And I think people will be surprised, actually, how much power, influence and say they get from winning the mandates in these big elections that are coming up.
I think it's also, as I remember the debates in many of those cities in the early days, of course, it was the local authorities that didn't want the elected mayors. I'm not sure the population didn't want the elected mayors. I think the population was probably largely neutral on the subject, but there was a pretty solid lobby from elected councillors who, you've got to say, obviously wanted to preserve their position in all this.
Yeah.
So that has also neutered the power of the mayors to some extent. I don't think that matters personally, because I think the mayors will accrete power quite quickly, because that's the way the system works.
Yeah.
So we'll quickly correct that. But I do think, and it's all about city leadership, there is no question about it, the Mayor of London has become a national figure. London is very much seen as a political force within the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the greatest thing we can achieve is do exactly the same with the Midlands and with Manchester and the other great cities, because we've got to do that.
Yeah.
They have got to actually start to really use their weight politically, use their weight economically. And, of course, they've also got to get themselves to the position where they are in a similar position to London, that they actually fight for resources, they fight for support, and, of course, can start to then show that they're not a drain on the UK economy, they're a positive contributor to the UK economy. And you'll only do that if you start creating power and start building it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a, you know, hopefully it's a very big and fundamental cultural change. It's an opportunity and a challenge. And if it works, people will need to build on the partnerships and relationships that did actually secure the combined authorities in the agreement on for devolution.
Yeah.
Because, okay, there was hesitancy among the local authorities, but they did work together. They did do the deals with the Chancellor. They secured significant extra resources. They have got important powers. But I think the election of the mayor can be used really to change the dynamic the place, to change the way in which it operates. And that's about raising ambition. It's about raising the pace of change to deliver economic growth, to make their cities strong. So I think that's a really big and important thing. And it will be a great tragedy if everybody involved in these new authorities doesn't see that opportunity and doesn't work together to grasp those opportunities.
Well, let's just explore that for a second. So your perspectives on, you know, if you think about the London mayoral system and the different relationships over times and at different times that Livingstone and Johnson had with the boroughs, for example. Obviously, they have the Assembly in London, which is an added element, which obviously is not there in the other six areas. But just a sense of as to how the mayor could and should be thinking about engaging with the local authorities or the combined authority. And obviously Johnson and Livingston did it slightly differently and in different times of their administrations. Neil, how did what can we learn from where the Livingston went about it, I suppose?
Well, I think there's a the way I put this, first of all, is to look at the position, not so much between Ken and the boroughs, although I could say there's obviously things to say about that. But when he first came to power in 2000, he was an independent. He didn't have any support at all on the Assembly, which at that stage had actually in some ways more powers than it does now, because it was the body that was responsible for appointing all the staff. Mm. And and could do a substantial degree of thwarting of his will if he had wished. He had no members on that body, and through a combination of low politics and soft politics, he went out of his way to construct alliances, not just actually with the Labour group, who in many ways some of them were the most hostile to him of all, but with the Greens, with the Liberal Democrats, indeed with the Conservative group, and brought together a situation where he did some deals, where he reached some agreements around staffing, around capacity, around how things would work. He built a degree of consensus and collaboration about how the mayoralty would operate. Mm. Mm. And I think that's exactly what needs to be done here.
And obviously at the time when Livingston came in, Ed, you were the leader of Wandsworth Council. Yeah. I mean, just a reflection on how he then engaged with you and your advice to the mayors of other places. How do you reflect on that?
There was the odd political spat that took place, but then you'd expect that. But generally speaking, the mayor concentrated on the big issues of the city. He wasn't getting involved, in my case, with what was happening in Wandsworth. Mm. That was not his priority. Mm. His priority was London-wide.
Yeah.
And he would work with all the authorities, and he did work with all the authorities. Similarly, I would say to you that Boris worked very successfully with all the local authorities. He always met the leaders when they wanted meetings, as indeed did Ken. And arrangements were made, and things were done. Mm. They were sorted. But there are enough big topics, big London-wide issues that the mayor can drive forward. And if I look, say, at London, and I'm sure these same sort of examples can be given in Manchester or Birmingham or any other city. I mean, you wouldn't have seen the Olympic bid, as Neil said earlier. You wouldn't have seen the Olympic Park and all of that come together. You wouldn't have seen some of the really big developments in London take place without real courage by the mayoralty. The mayoralty had to give that courage to the city.
Right.
And that's what it does.
Yeah.
And so I don't think, actually, there's as much politics in this as everybody wants to make out. No. Yes, of course, there is politics and there are spats. But the really big issues are where the city comes together. And that's when the mayoralty really works.
Yeah. So that division of responsibility or division of prioritisation and focus, that's a good thing to just have in your mind if you're to be the Metro Mayor of Manchester or Metro Mayor of Liverpool or West of England or Cambridge, whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think as Ed says, people who run big conventional local authorities will want an assurance that the mayor isn't going to be dipping his fingers into their day-to-day business. But the mayor's, if they understand their role, and I think most of the people I know who are standing here do understand their role, it is that it is strategic, it is city region wide. And you can think of the issues immediately where, that sort of spatial level is the right one. So you will be talking about big housing decisions and investments, and Ed in his role at the HCA will be an absolutely critical partner for many of these metro mayors, and they will be able to work, I think, more effectively across a broader area with the HCA. Transport, I mean, obviously an issue which needs to be done on a regional basis, and there are some big northern-wide transport issues that people will be concerned about, the plans for new rail investment, but also with the new powers over buses, which I think are really important for these new mayors, because it gives them an opportunity to improve bus services, to improve ticketing and integration. That's a real thing that they can get on with now, thanks to the Bus Act. And then issues around infrastructure, inward investment, economic development, skills, all these issues are ones which operate better at that broader level and where the mayor should give leadership. I think there is going to be, there's a tricky issue here in that one of the things in the governance here is that the local authority leaders are supposed each to have a particular portfolio of responsibilities. And I think that has to be made to work. And I don't think it's necessarily easy because, you know, if you are, I don't know, take anyone, if you are the leader of Trafford or the mayor of Salford and you're asked to take a citywide view in a big area, that doesn't necessarily come naturally to you. So I think giving support is very important. And I think there's a general point here about the new system and the new governance, which is that it's going to be really important to make sure that it isn't just the mayor who has the skills, resources and capacity to run these things. The combined authority and the other members of a combined authority are going to need that support and skills as well. Because while they have sort of different responsibilities and different functions, it's the exercise of those is through the mayoral combined authority. It is a different governance system. And so getting that right, making that work is really important. And one thing I do think about all these new authorities and the new mayoralities is they're very differently resourced and set up at the moment. Some are further ahead than others. And they've only got 3-year terms, that very short. So I think you talked about hitting the ground running. I mean, I think for all these authorities, you know, May, June and July are pretty big months, actually. Right. Because if you don't get things, a lot of stuff sorted up front, before you know it, you're going to be fighting the next round of the elections.
Yeah. How do they do that, Ed? I mean, how do they, you know, get into positions they're good to go on day one and they're, you know...
Well, I do actually think this is... If I had a criticism of all this is where my criticism would be.
Right.
And by the way, it's a criticism also of the London regime. I think there is actually... We would have been better off going down more of the American model on this, where you actually have an election and then you have a 3-month period before you take office. Mm. Because, quite frankly, you've got to hit the ground running and you've got no time to prepare. You're in the middle of an election campaign. Are you going to go around trying to negotiate with everybody, particularly from the other political parties, who's going to do what?
Yeah.
No, of course none of that's going to happen. So you're forced to do an awful lot in a very, very short space of time. And I think that is a fault. But having said that, I also think they're just going to have to get a move on. But I think this whole business of governance is going to be difficult. And I think this is where there is some risk in this. But also, it's where the reward is, because I think if these cities can show they're grown up enough to actually negotiate that properly, bury the political differences at least as enough to be able to deliver what's right for the city, then I think there is no reason why they wouldn't absorb a lot more power out of central government. And, you know, if there are any benefits from Brexit, those benefits are actually we're going to have to pass far more powers down to local cities and local communities.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is actually key to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do very much agree with that. And, I mean, but first of all, it's perhaps worth saying that, I mean, one can overdo the governance problems here. I mean, I'm struck by the fact that, I mean, people talk about the vetoes that the local authority leaders have, and they do have a 2/3 veto over money. And there are some things which have to be done unanimously. But actually, almost as critical is the fact that within the governance system, most of the combined authority decisions are going to be majority decisions. And unless the mayor supports it, you don't get the decision.
Yeah.
So the mayor actually has a corresponding veto. And I quite like, in some ways, 50-50 deadlock structures. I can remember when we were setting up the Olympic Park governance arrangements, for a time we had this thing where we had a company that was 50% government and 50% GLA. And if you have to agree to get anything done, it does tend to force agreement. So I would be, I hope, relatively optimistic about that. And I think people do need to come together. And I think the potential, if people can show that ability, I mean, actually, getting more powers, I agree with Ed, this can be done quite quickly. I think there is a momentum behind this. But I think that the responsibility, when government is so focused on Brexit, does sit very much with these people, and indeed with the Mayor of London. And I think there will be a need for people to come together, the elected mayors, with Sadiq Khan, to argue the case for devolution, because certainly, and I'm sure both Ed and I would agree with this, there's plenty of scope for more devolution to London as well, going even beyond what's been achieved. And I think if everybody comes together around a common agenda on that, it's a very powerful voice.
Yeah. Particularly if you've got a cross party group of mayors and cross-party group of local authorities.
That was my question
that
here.
That makes it pretty unstoppable, quite frankly.
Yeah. Because it's likely that at least three of them will probably be Labour, Liverpool, Manchester, probably Tees Valley. They're fairly strongly close
Tees Valley.
They're very strongly Labour areas. West Midlands, I think, is genuinely a contest. You can see that going both ways. West of England and Cambridge, similarly, you can see them being a Conservative mayor as much as a Labour mayor. In your experiences in London, did it help or hinder when the politics of the mayor were the same as the central government? You had that for a time under Livingstone, although he stood as an independent. He was then reintroduced into the Labour Party, notwithstanding. And then similarly, Johnson for a second term.
Does it
matter or not?
Yeah, I think it does matter. I think it does matter a bit. I mean, I think I think any mayor would prefer to the government to be of the same party as them, and you will get greater access. You have existing relationships. You can use that. You probably get better focus from officials and things like that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's critical. I mean, I think to be honest, in many ways, Ken often had, I would say, better relationships with some Conservative ministers than he did in the first period of his office, when basically he had sort of overturned Tony Blair with Labour people.
Yeah.
And I think, that there's always been, if you can make the case, if you can press the argument, the classic one here was, the deals over the first Crossrail line, obviously, those were, a lot of that was deals between Ken and the Conservative government and the Chancellor. So, and obviously the Olympics, where we saw people shopping around. So I don't think it's fatal. I do think, though, it is the case that if you have, plainly, I'm still a member of the Labour Party, just about. So I do hope that Sir Simon wins in the West Midlands, but he may not. Frankly, if he does, I think it'll be really important for him to work with his Conservative opponent, who is a big player in the West Midlands. And this cross-party coming together for the city region, is absolutely essential if you're going to have real credibility and get things done.
Yeah.
In my book, the best outcome of this is there is going to be a mix of all political complexions, and indeed none, if that's the way it goes.
Yeah,
because I think that just takes or eases the politics of the whole thing a little bit. But the point I wanted to make was that I think what's essential for all of these mayors is that they don't get themselves trapped in an ideological row. Because if they get themselves into that place, then they'll get absolutely nowhere, because then that's impossible. That's something that both Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson never did.
Never did, no.
They may have made some pretty robust statements at times that wound people up, but they always tempered it with a fair degree of common sense, which would enable them to negotiate and negotiate an outcome without it being... being to the detriment of the city.
Yeah.
I've got to say, you know, I look at these cities at the moment, and I think the hardest thing about it is that I don't get a sense that we're in the same position as, say, somewhere like Germany, where you've got really powerful cities right across the country. Here, at the moment, you have London and you have the rest.
Yeah.
And that's not a healthy place. Now, if we can get some real champions for these cities who manage to galvanise those communities, galvanise the politics in those places, we're going to be so much better off as a country.
And how do they go about doing that? I mean, how do we, that galvanising, that sort of sense of mission, that sense of purpose, the sense of, you know, this is an institution I want to be the leader of, and I'm going to wield the power that I've got. How do we ensure or support that to happen?
We all know what the likely big issues are going to be. It's going to be housing, it's going to be skills, it's going to be transport, it's these sort of areas. Mm-hmm. And all right, housing can to some extent be quite controversial, but the other two largely aren't. The housing one is more about an argument about the type of affordable housing, not necessarily whether it's needed or not. It's just going to be an argument whether you want more rented or more shared ownership. I mean, but you're not arguing about the need for it.
Not quite.
And nobody's arguing the quantum. So
no.
I think these are the big areas. And transport, as Neil said earlier, is to me the biggest one. I mean, whenever anybody talks to me about regeneration, I used to think there were lots of components in regeneration. I don't anymore. I think there's only one. It's called transport. If you get the transport right, everything else will follow one way or another.
Yeah.
Might take a while, but it will get there.
Yeah.
And there's these big transport levers these cities just don't have.
No.
But they will have.
They will have.
And those are really important.
They will have. And I think it operates at a number of levels for transport stuff. I mean, I'm actually quite, unlike some people, I think HS2 is a very good project, a very exciting project. And it's certainly an incredibly exciting project for the West Midlands and for Birmingham.
Yeah.
If you look at the opportunities in Birmingham, in a sense, you may get some really healthy competition between Birmingham and Manchester, it seems to me, here. But I think Birmingham is beginning really to move forward. I mean, you can see the investment that's going in already. You've got HSBC moving in there. You've got the big Deutsche Bank office moving in there. You've got a huge amount of development going on. You've got lots of other opportunities. You've got the big site at Smithfield. You've got the Curzon Street HS2 station. You've got this amazing opportunity around Jaguar Land Rover and the airport and the HS2 interchange station. Now, really catalysing and making the most of these opportunities to build new housing, to expand it. I mean, Birmingham should be aiming to have a huge growth spurt, a really ambitious plan for economic growth, for housing growth. And I think, you know, that's a really powerful story, which with HS2, you know, beginning to be built now, we're not talking about it being too far off now. There's real opportunity to see a big boom in the West Midlands. I think the same does apply in Manchester and Liverpool, where there are also terrific opportunities. Look at the new port in Liverpool, the Superport, and the things that's going on there with economic growth, the potential for new industrial growth there. I mean, there are huge opportunities here. And I think having these mayors should really provide, or if it just works, can provide the leadership that will mean that these things happen more quickly, that they happen more effectively, that there are stronger partnerships, where you get better outcomes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, those cities have got to, I think, grasp some of their real issues that are affecting them. I think they are suffering a terrible problem about an identity. What are they? What is the future of those cities? What are those cities about?
Yeah.
I mean, Manchester, I think, clearly shows what it's about. I'm not sure about some of the others. You can put your hand on heart and know exactly what they're trying to achieve. And I think this is an opportunity. It's about skills, it's about getting... But it's also about dealing with some of those deep-rooted problems. I mean, you've got terrible deprivation in some of these cities.
Yeah.
But it's been there for a very long time. And you've got to ask yourself the question, you know, it's been there for donkey's years. What's now changing? because the political machine has been there.
Yeah.
So what are they going to do to actually change it? What's going to be different? And that's been hopefully a mayor will focus.
Yeah, and that's been one of the themes in all of the mayoral places, even in places like Cambridge and Peterborough, which are typically, you know, on average much wealthier than the other places. There has been an ongoing theme across all of them, which is about how do we ensure that places and people benefit from some of the fantastic opportunities that you were just talking about. So it'll be interesting to see how they address those pockets of disadvantage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a really difficult issue, and it's always the most difficult thing in areas where you are seeing regeneration and economic growth, which is how do you make sure you don't just rely on some sort of trickle-down notion. How do you really put in place for programs? And a huge amount of this is around skills and education, actually, that do enable people to access new opportunities that come with economic growth. I think if you're talking about areas where there should be more devolution, you know, skills is one where there is much, much more to be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at actually what's happened in terms of skills devolution, it's pretty thin, you know. The big money is still not locally determined, you know. There isn't the sort of links with employers that would much best be done at the local level in terms of working up new programs. I know I can remember Boris actually being very frustrated when he chaired the LEP in London, simply about the fact that we didn't really have the levers, the vocational education system, we had really no say over it, effectively. So I think that's a real area where the need for greater devolution, greater local delivery and local accountability is essential.
Mm. We just turn a little bit, get your reflections and then for thoughts on, you know, day one, mayors are in place. They need to. They're nowhere near as well resourced as, you know, the London version, but nevertheless need to sort of think about their building their teams. Think about the relationship between whether they will have representatives or deputy mayors in the way that we see them in London. They'll have senior advisors or senior staff. You know, building that team. Your reflections on the way that Livingstone went about that, Johnson went about that, and you know, what would we be advising those metro mayors when they go about doing that?
Well, this is quite a tricky question, because one of the things that always happens, and it inevitably happens, and it's not completely wrong, is that someone comes into power. It's going back to Ed's point about the time period you have. You come into power and you've got your campaign team around you, and your campaign team have won you the election. And inevitably, you end up relying to a very large extent on your campaign team. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is the case that it's not necessarily... The campaigning skills don't necessarily mesh with the governing skills.
Yes.
And so, you know, one needs to avoid at all costs sort of withdrawing into a bunker surrounded by your campaign team. You have to trust and build relationships with the officers and the officials who are going to support you. Now, one of the issues, I think, in a number of these of the areas where they're going to be mayors, is that capacity just doesn't exist.
No.
And you have some people who are seconded in part-time, who have probably got very important full-time jobs elsewhere. And I think that is a real problem that people are going to have to grapple with very fast. In all these authorities, the position of the head of the paid service is an absolutely critical one, because the head of the paid service has the staffing powers and hires the staff. So the mayor determines the budget. Now, I think, my personal view very strongly, is that if you're the head of the paid service, you should see yourself as primarily working for the mayor.
For the mayor.
Mm. For the mayor. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean you ignore the fact that there's a combined authority with other members on it. I don't think that in every one of these localities at the moment that principle is understood or internalised.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's not, there will be difficulty, because the mayor must have the ability to bring staff in, to form his team, and enough clout and the ability to do that. I think it will mean that people will need to look at where there is existing capacity. So say if you become a mayor of Liverpool, the most obvious place where there's existing citywide capacity is in Mersey Travel, some in the LEP. And in the early days, you're going to have to use that. People are going to have to be flexible. You're going to have to get people together and try and make progress. But that is an absolutely first order task. You know, I mean, I think both in the West Midlands and in the Liverpool there isn't a permanent head of paid service in post.
No.
Now, in some ways, you could say that's a good thing because at least the mayor will have some say over that. But you've got to get that person who is, you know, going to work with the mayor and with the other members of a combined authority in post, trusted by the mayor, respected by the other members of a combined authority, and that needs to happen pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's quite regrettable in some ways that that hasn't been done everywhere.
Very good. Ed, I mean, building a team, I get your thought on, you know, chief of staff. When we did lots of interviews about, you know, what worked for the mayoral system, having a very effective chief of staff seemed to be a pretty universal reflection on the London system. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I think it's probably a fair reflection on most top jobs, quite frankly. I think you've got to have somebody who can speak for the mayor and act for the mayor, and the mayor can send in to sort things out because the mayor can't do everything. It's just impossible. Much of the mayor's job is a public-facing role.
Yeah.
So you've got to have people around you to get in there and basically impose your will. And that's their job.
Yeah.
So appointing these people, and Neil's absolutely right, you've got to find the right people. People that are respected as well. People who people believe are capable of doing the job.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you're measured as a mayor by the people you surround yourself with. And that is also an important point. So if you can get some really good people early on working for you, pushing this through, your life becomes so much more easy.
Mm.
If, of course, all that you're doing is arriving there, sitting down in a nice office, and that the existing town clerk or whoever it is says, oh, I've got a couple of spare staff over there you could have to look after you, and then ignores you, that will be a recipe for utter disaster. I'm being a bit extreme with that example.
Yeah.
But the fact remains is you've got to grip control very, very quickly and be seen to grip control. You've got to do those negotiations with those borough leaders or key people within the existing authority. You've got the key officers of the authority you've got to have a relationship with. This is hard work. Mm. There's a lot of people here you've got to pull together. And as Neil says, once you start moving into some of the other areas like travel, like LEPs, and indeed we touched on earlier skills, which I agree with Neil on this, is probably the single biggest weakness in the London system. And I think very quickly, you know, what happens if you're in Birmingham and the chief executive of Jaguar Land Rover comes along on day two and says, congratulations, now I can't get enough apprenticeships, what are you going to do about it?
That's a good claim, and
you've got to deliver at that
point. And I suppose that's absolutely right. I mean, the other thing which I think people will need to do, obviously, they'll need to do a lot of reaching out, which they will have done to some extent already, but reaching out in a relationship with the business community. I think reaching out to young people is really important at the moment. It's an issue, a big political issue, the comparatively poor prospects of young people and this concern about future generations and how will their life chances and prospects stand up against their parents' generations. And I think that will be a big priority, the voluntary and community sector. But you do, as long as you don't go crazy about this, you also have the ability to pull people in to work with you, people from the great universities in these cities, strong people from there, people from, the big RSLs who are housing providers in these cities, you know, reaching out and being clear about roles. I mean, you can create sort of non-posts or talking shops or things like that, which one should avoid doing. But drawing on the skills of and abilities of a very broad range of people in the city is a way to broaden civic leadership and really, to get tremendous value for nothing, in effect.
Yeah.
And people will welcome the chance to come and work for their city and to do that. And I think that's another thing. So that reaching out is going to be really important, particularly trying to get over some of this feeling. I mean, there is this anxiety about the extent of popular legitimacy. I agree with what Ed said, but I don't think people are necessarily against having these mayors. But I don't think they're necessarily very much in favour of them.
Yeah, it's pretty rare if you ask anybody if you want more politicians. Yes, please.
It's quite striking. One of the things I say about, you've only got a 3-year term, and then you've got, you know, a longer term. So you've got to have these two timescales in mind. If you actually look at the turnout in the first London mayoral election, which was a big deal election, you had Ken standing and, you know, and there was a huge furore going on about it. The turnout was only 34% in that election. You know, and if every year, every election, it's gone up 34, 37, 38, 46. And that's a measure of the success of the institution.
Mm.
So if I suspect turnouts are not going to be that great this time,
no.
But they better go up next time, or these things will not have succeeded. We will be able to see that they haven't actually caught the popular imagination or the popular, or got the degree of popular support they need.
And that'll be about making sure that in that short window, that initial 3 years, they're focused on stuff which is visible, where even if there's some quick wins that you can see happen that, you know, people can respond to and react to, as well as setting out, I guess, some longer term perspectives on how they want their city to evolve and how they want to do all of that sort of stuff.
They've also got some quite powerful levers. I mean, you know, when you look at things like policing and things like this, which there's a bit of sort of mixed messages about this going on out at the moment. But the fact is, these are the big organs of the city you've got to work with and get working for you. Just going back to the other point, I think it's also about, in my book, it's also about the universities. I mean, I think I would make them my first port of call I got my team in place and try and strike some deals with those universities, because that's your front door in many cases to the world. In all of those cities we're talking about, well, most, not all, most of them, the universities are better known than the cities.
Than the cities, yes.
They're pretty important to you.
And
they can actually take you to where you perhaps need to go.
So as we come towards a close, what would be the pitfalls that you would be advising the mayors to keep an eye on in terms of, you know, the way they behave or the choices they make or the positions they set out? Again, you know, drawing on your experiences of working with the first two mayors in London, what would you be saying? You know, you're going to do X, you're going to do Y, but,
well, again, I'm probably repeating some of the things I've already said during our discussion. As I say, I think you've got to reach out. You mustn't, you know, get a retreat behind a narrow political group, particularly people you've worked with in the election. You've got to be fleet-footed. You know, you have hit the ground running fray. I mean, it's a cliche, but it really, really is important, particularly given how far behind they are at the moment. You mustn't get distracted into, you know, minor rows and disputes around local, you know, genuinely sort of local authority issues. Really pitch it for the big picture, the big issues, and be willing to compromise, you know, make sure your relationships are solid. I mean, to be fair, this is the stuff of politics, as, you know, Ed knows better than me. You've got to be able to get on with people. You've got to be able sometimes to do deals which you wouldn't ideally like to do in order to get over the line with things. I mean, you have to start with your relationships with the other members of a combined authority. And not all of those are going to be easy. It will take time for everyone to come online, but you've got to start constructing a proper coalition, a consensus. You've got some quite big core periphery issues in these places, you know. And again, I think you mustn't allow that to solidify as an issue. It's not, you know, the Howard Bernstein Manchester against Alderman and everybody, it isn't the Joe Anderson Liverpool against Knowsley and Halton and everywhere. Yeah. If you get into that sort of thing, you really will have had it.
Yeah. Ed, what would be your pitfalls to avoid?
Neil's absolutely right. It's big picture stuff, and you need to keep it at big picture level.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean to say you don't have to do an awful lot of detailed work, because I'm afraid you always have to do a lot of detailed work. And I think being mayor is actually very much hard work, and it's really going to... I think they'll be measured by that. I think they've got to accept that wheels do fall off, I'm afraid. And some wheels are bigger wheels than others, and some of them can be pretty disastrous when they come off. And you've got to be able to be fleet of foot to be able to deal with that as well, because that will happen. And it's not necessarily about things going wrong. It's what you do to put them right after they've gone wrong. And I think that requires a lot of maturity and a lot of political nous, which they're going to have to show to be able to deal with those issues. But other than that, I think I think we will be badly let down as you know, those of us who believe, as Neil and I do, in devolved authorities and believe that power is best out there. Within the cities themselves, we'll all be let down badly if these mayors aren't up to the job. They have got to actually recognise that the devolution of power to the cities now is going to be decided upon their performance. Because if they all perform well, there'll be nothing to stop more powers being devolved. If they just don't succeed, then I think that's a great loss. And I'm afraid that in government, there's a lot of people who don't want them to succeed. Don't let's kid ourselves on that. This wasn't an experiment, if you like, which is universally supported.
No.
There's a lot who don't want it in all political parties. So, these guys have got to succeed. And that means they're going to have to show leadership, real leadership.
A good challenge on which to end. My guests today have been Sir Edward Lister and Neil Coleman. Thanks very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.